Welcome to TechNation Health, reimagining the future of health and healthcare with the emergence of new technologies and breakthrough science. Today on TechNation Health, moving cancer treatments from infusions to pills, and Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft tells us about circadian medicine. Normally, when we talk about cancer treatments, we're talking about infusions, which take some time to administer. Curis is working on cancer treatments which can be taken orally in a pill. I asked Ali Fateh, the CEO of Curis, how is that possible?
Actually, everything that we work on at Curis, the drugs that we try to develop are, in fact, oral drugs. And we intentionally do that because it makes it much more convenient for the patients. And then secondly, from a cost perspective, we do think that manufacturing the small molecule, as we refer to them, oral drugs, are, in fact, quite a bit simpler. And they can be mass-produced and hopefully much more available as well.
That's really great, but aren't all these cancer drugs big, large molecules that can't be made into pills?
For some of them, that is still potentially possible. Our efforts is try to figure out any of the places for cancer treatment that we try to intervene, if we can actually generate an oral drug in a pill form that we can administer it for the patients, especially for their convenience. And in many of those cases, we have been able to do that. And we have those pill form of the drugs, in fact, in clinical testing now in patients, and they seem to have good benefits for them as well.
Now, if I look at a really large molecule, a typical one that would be a cancer treatment, it's just huge. It's just huge, relatively speaking, in molecule terms. And when I look at the patents on them, the active ingredients that have been patented, it's only little bitty parts of those. If you just took those and put them together, they might be small enough to make into a pill. Is that one approach?
That's a very difficult approach. And the reason that may not work or not be as successful, as you pointed out, these are small parts of the large molecules, which are the parts that, in fact, do the work, do need a fairly large scaffold, if you will, with them to hold those in the right places. So taking those little small parts of them and trying to imagine putting those together then makes it, from a three-dimensional perspective, not be in the right places. And that's what makes it difficult. You can do it, but it won't work. That's probably the case.
So how do you do it?
We actually take a different approach. We look at, again, also the three-dimensional structure of what it is that we're trying to intervene with. For example, thinking about a cancer cell, what is on the surface of a cancer cell, which is what we want to target. We can now, in fact, look at the three-dimensional structure of those proteins on the surface of the cancer cells, and then using computer-aided discovery approaches, design actual chemical structures. And these are the same chemical compounds that can actually bind to those same proteins on the surface of the cancer cells and then alleviate the need for making a large molecule in this regard.
So the reason they call it biopharma is that they are biological molecules which are being infused into cancer patients. And you're saying, if we can find a chemistry, a chemical that we can construct, then these small chemical entities we can make into pills. They might do the same things. One's a biological, one's a chemical. But you're saying, but if we can do chemistry, then we get all the advantages of a pill.
That is correct. That's exactly correct. In a sense, thinking about it as a chemical, that's the pharma part, that has very strong biological activity, which is, in our case, an anti-cancer activity. And we've been successful. Many of the anti-cancer drugs that we use now are in a pill form, orally available, and they're manufactured as a chemical.
Now, when you say many, we hear time after time after time of these infusions. Why are so many people still going to infusion centers for their treatments?
So cancer, of course, has many different causes. And in fact, the genetic causes provides us areas to intervene and target. Some of those areas where we want to intervene are just very difficult to try and address with a chemical structure, either because of the size of the chemical structure or the way that they naturally work, in which case then a biological approach, for example, with an antibody biological drug may work better. We tried all the different approaches. We think about them as biologic modalities, chemical pill form drug modalities, and obviously more recently thinking about gene therapy modalities. It really depends on the step in the cancer formation that we want to intervene with, which of these modalities may be the best one. 9 times out of 10, if we can do it with an oral pill form, we want to go that direction.
Now, whether it's a pill or it's a large molecule that has to be infused, you still have to go through all the phases at the FDA testing them. I know that one of your pills is in a phase 1 study here in the U.S., and yet it's in a phase 2 study in India. Did you start earlier? Why are you in India?
Yeah, it's a good question. We have a number of drugs that we have in clinical testing. The one that you refer to, it is correct. We have that in the U.S. in phase 1 or the early dose-finding testing that FDA allowed us to do in patients here in the U.S., in cancer patients. This particular drug is an oral form of a thing that has now only been addressed with biologics, and it's in the field of very popular field of cancer immunotherapy, which is activating our own immune system, in fact, to attack the cancer. The reason we went to India is really for access to patients that haven't previously been treated with these type of drugs. It's such a hot field currently in the U.S., more than 1,000, or in fact, more than 2,000 different trials are looking for patients that haven't been treated with these types of drugs to test new approaches to cancer treatment. India is a very large country. These drugs as biological form are not available in India, which means it's a large population of cancer patients that have never been treated with cancer immunotherapy. And it affords us the opportunity to actually be able to enroll patients. In the U.S. right now, and especially for cancer immunotherapy, competition for patients is very high. Therefore, we do look in this case, more globally, where are the geographies that these drugs are not available for patients? Therefore, we have the opportunity to try and test our drugs and figure out whether they provide anything additional or other advantages for patients.
And we won't see if there are any complications which had been created by using the earlier drugs.
That is exactly correct. That cancer clinical trials or any clinical trial is really an experiment. It's an experiment that we want to do in patients for testing our drug. Of course, they've been tested quite heavily before they go into patients to make sure there are no major toxic effects associated with them. However, just like any experiment, we want to make it as clean or controlled as possible. If a patient has been treated with these types of drugs before, and they're now still a cancer patient, then it's less likely that they will be able to benefit from a similar type of a drug, even though in our case, it's in an oral pill form versus being an injectable biologic.
I have two questions for you. First of all, does having it go through these phases ahead of the U.S. phase, does that inform the U.S. phase?
It does. We really do think about humans are humans no matter where they are. As long as the clinical trials are done in a manner and the information is collected in a very controlled manner, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration will accept that information. And it allows us to supplement information that we gain from trials in the United States to be able to potentially file for approval of a drug. The important thing is the quality of the information that we gain and the quality and the controlled nature of the clinical trials that we conduct. A lot of the parts of the world are now recognizing this, and they have the ability to be able to allow us to do these trials in patients in different parts of the world.
Well, the second question is, here's India, offered up its people participated. Will it get this drug in India?
is an excellent point, and I think this is an important part. First and foremost, for any of us that are in the drug development world, and in particular for cancer, we want to make it available for patients all over the world, not just in the United States. We're also, in the case of Curis, fortunate to be partnered with a company in India whose mission is really to provide these same drugs to patients in India. They work with us in collaboration, and if these data or this information from the trials are successful, we will use them for U.S. and other parts of the world, including Europe. And our partner company in India, whose name is Aurigene, their intent and their mission is to, in fact, generate those drugs for patients in India and provide them to those patients as well.
Well, thank you for coming in, Ali. I hope you come back. Keep us informed.
Thank you very much, Maura, and look forward to it.
Ali Fateh is the CEO of Curis. More information is available at curis.com. That's C-U-R-I-S, curis.com. I think it was somewhere in college when we all started talking about our circadian rhythms. I asked our chief correspondent, Dr. Daniel Kraft, remind me, what's that?
What's your sign, baby? What's your sign? Are you in the groove?
Groovy. I'm in the groove. Yeah. Groovy man.
Well, life is a set of patterns, right? Our cells, our physiology, we all live in pretty much 24-hour cycles, but also seasonal cycles. And we're just starting to open this new realm of sort of circadian health and medicine and understand the implications of normal rhythms, you know, the daily 24-hour clock, sleep, wake cycles, alertness, and what happens when we start to mess with that, whether that's with international travel and jet lag, our computer screens and phones, you know, looking at them at midnight, or what happens to folks who do late night shifts or eat at 2 a.m. Lots of implications. It's a fascinating time to look at our rhythms.
Well, certainly before we had all this technology, you know, you went to sleep with the dark and you woke up with the light. So that's the first thing that changed what was going on in a mass societal way. But now we have all our new technologies. We'll just leap forward. You know, we've got cell phones, we've got tablets, we've got computers, we've got television sets, we've got all of these things. What's that doing? Does that mean we change our circadian rhythm or do we interfere with it?
I think we're doing both. I mean, if you think back to our ancestors, not even that many generations back. I mean, we've only had electric lighting 150 years, Thomas Edison. But our ancestors, you know, they lived through the day-night cycles. You know, maybe they had candlelight, but their days very much shifted with the sun. And they had natural lighting, and they certainly weren't exposed to fluorescent light bulbs. Now in our modern era, yes, things are more fast-paced. We have artificial light. Many of us don't get outside as much. And many of us are now addicted to our mobile devices and looking at Twitter and Facebook at 11:30 before we go to bed. And new science and studies have shown that that definitely starts to affect our circadian rhythm, how much melatonin we make, which affects how we sleep, our timing and our depth of sleep, our REM sleep, which is really important for developing memory and preventing everything from heart disease to depression. So we are messing with it, and we're starting to understand it, however.
One of the things that has changed with all this technology and sort of changing social patterns and the fact that you can order anything you want and have it delivered to your house at any time, apparently, right from your smartphone, is what time we eat. And how much we eat and what we eat. How is that affecting us?
Well, we now have 24/7 lighting. We also have 24/7 food access. And it's fascinating how the timing of when we eat can dramatically impact health. So some fascinating work on circadian timing and diet has been done and pioneered by Professor Sachin Panda at the Salk Institute in San Diego. And they'd studied, for example, mice, essentially identical mice. And one set of mice could eat whenever and whenever they wanted, so 24/7 access to food. Their sibling mice, who were genetically identical, could only eat 10 hours of the day. And while both sets of mice would eat essentially the same amount of calories, those mice that had restricted, they could only eat 10 hours of the day, had dramatically lower body weight and body fat. So they were much healthier when they could only eat in a certain window of the day. And that's now starting to translate to humans. You may have heard of intermittent fasting. When you go to bed at night, let's say 10 o'clock, you don't eat again until, let's say, noon the next day. So people are experimenting with this. And Dr. Panda's group also did a project, mycircadianclock.org was the platform for this, where people would report when they ate and how much they ate. And they studied the group that then shifted to not eating for 10-hour windows. And those folks reversed some of their diseases and had better numbers and more alertness and energy and reversals of some important biomarkers like blood pressure and cholesterol. And so, again, timing might be everything, including in our diets.
So restricting maybe only to those times when it's light out to match our great ancestors, that's when you eat. And then when it gets dark, you sleep, or you could sleep a long time in the dark.
You could still, it may improve you getting your 8 hours of sleep because you haven't just involved a meal, which changes your cortisol and other levels. And there's some other simple things that Dr. Panda talks about that helps with sleep in general. Number one, not to eat for a couple hours before you go to bed, as we just talked about, to sleep in a cooler environment. We tend to sleep better and more efficiently in a cool room rather than a warm room, to avoid those bright lights before bed. And there's now technologies, now most of our smartphones know after 10 o'clock to turn down the brightness and often change the timbre to be more like a blue light. And that is apparently effective in improving our sleep. So sometimes these simple little habits, which aren't hard to do, can improve our sleep physiology and our eating physiology and our health outcomes.
Well, I was just reaching back into those early ancestors of mine. And, you know, here they are and they're in the cave and they got the, you know, the animal skins over them. Nobody's going to get up and go over to the refrigerator and open it. It's like they're going to have to take their food and make it with no access to animals that may be roaming around. It's like, yeah, it's like that's exactly where we were coming from.
So. You're not going to get eaten by the lion for that 2 a.m. snack. Now we have the ability, you know, with our wearables to study our sleep. I'm wearing, you know, an Apple Watch and a Fitbit. Both of those actually track my sleep pretty well. And
I know, I check you. Every time you come in, I say, what else does he have on his body? But okay, just two today.
Just two today. But what's interesting about those can give not just me insights, but I'm starting to crowdsource my sleep data. And now companies like Fitbit and others have billions of hours of sleep and nights. And we're starting to learn what's normal sleep patterns, what happens as we age. And all that, as we start to crowdsource it and understand it, will hopefully help us help our sleep hygiene and figure out our circadian rhythms in new, powerful ways. And it's not just for our health and our habits. It may be if we're taking a medication, a blood pressure medication, or even a flu vaccine, the time of day that you take that medication or get that vaccination may impact how well that drug works or that vaccination works. Our immune system follows different circadian rhythms as well in terms
throughout the day.
Throughout the day or potentially in different seasons. There's been studies to look at patients who have open heart surgery. They do better when they have the surgeries in the afternoon rather than early in the morning. So you might want to, if you have heart surgery and you get a choice, say, doc, I'd like it in the early afternoon as opposed to 6 a.m. Hopefully the surgeons are more awake as well, but also your physiology may be more attuned to a better outcome. So it's the early days of understanding circadian rhythms for health prevention and even for therapy.
Right now, it sounds like we're just sort of watching outcomes to see, oh, it appears if we do this, the outcome is better. Can we measure circadian rhythms, or is this really a description of how we operate, sort of the outside of being human?
Well, there are different things that you can measure in terms of rhythms. It may be your brain waves. It could be your heart rate and your heart variability. It might be hormones that correlate through the circadian rhythm, like cortisol and stress hormones. So there are a variety of ways to measure our circadian rhythms. And as we can now do that more seamlessly in our digital health environment, we'll be able to do these on the fly. We can all start to contribute and even learn that we're not all the same. You know, we have different genetics of sleep. Some of us need 6 hours. Some of us need 9. Some of us may have different receptors in our eyes that makes us more prone to light exposure. Some of the work by Sachin Panda was discovering a new molecule in the eye called melanopsin, which is sort of wired to the master clock in our brain. And so if you learn to stimulate certain elements in our retina with a certain type of light, you may be able to reshape or shift your rhythms. So interesting time to start to measure and start to modify and do that in a more personalized, precise way as well.
Well, you gave us a lot to think about today. I think I'll go to sleep tonight.
I need a nap.
Worry about it. Worry about it tomorrow. Thank you so much, Daniel.
Thank you, Myra.
Dr. Daniel Kraft is chief correspondent of TechNation Health and the founder and chair of Exponential Medicine. More information is available at exponentialmedicine.com. For TechNation Health, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancourt.